became so well known because I think there 10,000 people died on that. And they're laying alongside the trails and stuff from dying from sickness, malnutrition, all that stuff on the trail of tears.
This was under President Andrew Jackson.
Yes, yes.
The president who President Trump revered.
Order, yeah. He was he was a hater. And so we organized under basically the same policies of exposing what was done in the past and continued to be done. And we still find it's still happening today, Amy. Ann Coulter had made a public statement that about Native people that we didn't kill enough of them Indians. That's a very dangerous thing to say about anybody, because there's a bunch of nuts out there, like you could take one of them haters and everything. I mean, he could end up killing a lot of innocent Natives for just because those type of words. You got a president trying to do away with our treaties. If our treaties go, we go. This is the only thing to prove that we are a sovereign nation and a race of people. And if that goes, we go as a race of people. So it's not ending for us. We're still in danger. Yeah, you see it happening in the streets. You know, I mean, right today. Look at what they're doing in Palestine. Killing women, children, babies, unborn babies. That's what they did to us, man. And here it is, still happening.
So 52 years ago, 1973, the start of the American Indian Movement, 71-day occupation of the village of Wounded Knee on Pine Ridge Reservation, yeah. Occupation helping draw international attention to the plight of Native Americans, the U.S. government responding to the occupation with a full military siege, that included armored personnel carriers, F-4 Phantom jets, U.S. Marshals, FBI, state and local enforcement. During the occupation, two Sioux men shot dead by federal agents, and a black civil rights activist, Ray Robinson, went missing. The FBI confirmed in 2014, decades later, that Ray Robinson had been killed during the standoff. Most people don't know about this history.
No.
Maybe they've heard the book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. So can you talk about Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee, especially for young people who don't know the history?
Well, I was in jail during the beginning of Wounded Knee, but I got out, was about halfway through. Then I went up there and I helped pack in stuff into Wounded Knee, and I stayed out there on the outside forces. After we made all those trips to Washington and all stuff, all those other demonstrations and all those promises, they were going to do this and do that. They were going to investigate everything, all of our acquisitions and all that stuff. And we soon found out, we knew anyway, but we soon found out that it was all a lie. They weren't going to investigate, and they didn't. And so finally, elders and the chiefs made the decision to go to Wounded Knee. AIM had no part in that decision. We cannot go any place in the Indian country and make policies. We can't. That is not us. We can't do that. Now, and we can't go unless we're invited by those people. They just got fed up with so many more false promises and what was happening. They were being terrorized by a group organized by a mercenary group, I might add. They were provided with intelligence, armored person, ammunition, sophisticated weapons, surveillance and stuff like this, automobiles and stuff. And the leader made that admitted that on a national interview, So we know that's all true. They tried to deny it at first, but they called themselves the Guardians of the Ogallala Nation. And
the goons.
The goons.
Dick Wilson's.
Dick Wilson, all of them. Nixon ordered the 82nd Airborne to go and investigate what's going on down there. And if we were like the government was claiming that we were communists and Marxists and we were being financed by the communists, they were to go out there and wipe us out. When Nixon got the 82nd Airborne involved in it, we filed a lawsuit, and it took us 10 years. But we got all this information out of the files that they had to turn over to us, right? And we found that they had went to the armory and checked out 250,000 rounds of various caliber ammunition, different sophisticated weaponry, armored personnel carriers, and finances and surveillance and stuff like that. See, that was all illegal. And that's how we found out a lot of stuff about what they were doing there, and was all illegal. If it would have been left to Nixon, he was going to wipe us out. But he didn't, because we heard his wife step forward and said, "No, don't you do that."
Now, still going back 50 years, what landed you in jail? I want to go to the words in Democracy Now! In 2003, the occupation of Wounded Knees considered the beginning of what Oglala people refer to as the Reign of Terror from 73 to 76. Over 60 residents killed in this period. Murders went uninvestigated by the FBI, which had jurisdiction. The period culminating in the June 26 shootout, for which Leonard Peltier was imprisoned.
First of all, I don't know who the shooter is. Our shooters. And I wouldn't tell you if I did know. So I'm not going to tell you anything in that area. But I'll tell you, I'll speak on the other issues, because it's public knowledge, and it's been our attempts to continue to expose that stuff. But there were a lot of Native people, traditionalists, whose homes were burned, whose houses were drive-by shootings. People were pulled over and beaten, and some shot, some killed. And those things are literally recordings on this. We got records of all this stuff now. So people can't deny this stuff. The only ones that are denying this is the United States government, the FBI, and people like that. But we faced a time called the Reign of Terror, when they were getting away with all this. None of them were going to investigate. A lot of the older people that seen these people identified them, but the FBI still wouldn't investigate. They were able to kill people at random. They were and getting away with it, because they had no fear of being prosecuted. The only fear they had was of us, the American Indian Movement, because we wouldn't take their every chance we got together, we got a confrontation with them. And that's the only fear they had of anything, of any retaliations, any arrests or anything else.
We're spending the hour with Indigenous elder Leonard Peltier. He was released in February from prison after nearly 50 years behind bars. Stay with us.
Yahweh. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier, released to home confinement in February after nearly half a century behind bars, I asked him about his claims that his extradition from Canada and trial in the United States were marked by prosecutorial misconduct.
Talk about the coerced testimony of Myrtle Pourbaix, who she is.
Who is she?
I mean, I know you didn't know her at the time.
Well, I never knew her. Her father came to my, was going to come testify at my trial that she had a serious mental problem. And her sister was going to testify that on the day of the shootout, they were sitting there drinking beer. And we got this all on tape. And they were sitting there drinking beer, and they ran out of beer. And they were watching TV, she said. And they decided to make a run off the reservation because it was a dry reservation. No alcohol was allowed there. And so to go buy some more beer, come back and watch some more TV. And they started driving down the road, and all of a sudden a bulletin came over the radio. Big shootout in Ogallala between marshals, FBI, BIA cops, goon squads against the American Indian Movement. So they were over 50 miles away. Finally, Myrtle admitted that she didn't know me. And,
her testimony
in the grand jurors when he got us all indicted.
Said she was your girlfriend and she had seen.
She witnessed. Oh God.
Seen this, all of this.
This was when the lawyers came to me in Canada. They said, Leonard. They said, Leonard, we got bad news for you. And I said, yeah. What kind of bad news? And they said, your girlfriend's testifying against you. And I looked at him, I said, my girlfriend? What do you mean, my girlfriend? He said, your girlfriend. And I said, I don't have a girlfriend. I got a wife, two kids.
So talk about James Reynolds, the former U.S. attorney in charge of the prosecution that helped convict you. Mm-hmm. He later becomes an advocate for your release, stating the prosecution could not prove that you had committed any offense and the conviction was unjust. He wrote to president after president. He himself was appointed by Carter right through to Biden.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, about 10 years ago, James Reynolds started to have a change of heart, I guess. James Reynolds said that there is no evidence Leonard Peltier committed any crimes on that reservation. And that's pretty, he was in charge of everything.
What this ultimately leads to is your imprisonment for 49 years.
Yep.
The majority of your life behind bars, what this institutionalization meant for you, what it meant to be both a prisoner and considered a political prisoner around the world and a symbol of the fight for Native American rights and what happens to you when you engage in it, all of those things.
Well, okay, I think I've been asked this question quite a bit and it's hard for me to answer, but I think what really kept me strong was my anger. I was extremely angry about what they did to me and my people. And I'm still very, very angry. And there was no way in hell I was going to get justice. I could have had at least 14 constitutional issues that I should have been released on, at least that many. And I knew I wasn't going to get it. I knew it was the courts were not going to give it to me. And I mean, even the Supreme Court wouldn't refuse to hear my case and stuff like that. But I knew why. You know, I found evidence of them meeting with Judge Haney. And Judge Haney became a strong advocate for my release. But we found evidence. He worked with the FBI. And I felt so much hate and anger, and what they did to Native people in this country, this continent. And that kept me strong. It kept me from, I've been offered numerous times, a few times anyway, that if I accepted responsibility and made statements that everything we've said negative about the United States government, what their past history was and their dealings with our with us as people in the nation, and they would turn me loose, and I refused to do that. I refused to bow down to them, and I still refuse to bow down to them. I'm gonna die with my beliefs. And I just refuse to. To me, it's treason against my nation, my people.
You're a major symbol of indigenous power, not only in the United States, but around the world. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
Well, I hope I can use it to benefit my people. I mean, as I said earlier, we're still in danger. It's not over for us. We don't get to live like the rest of the people in this country, and free, without fear of what would happen to us if we had our treaties taken away from us. We don't get to live like that. We still have to live under that fear. Of losing our identity, losing our culture, our religion and stuff. Most Americans don't have to worry about that. We do. And so the fight for the struggle still goes on for me. I'm not going to give up. I have not surrendered. I don't want to go back to prison. I heard that Trump was going to try to take away all the of Biden's pardons and everything else like that.
What would you say to young indigenous people? I'm looking behind you at a photograph of, is it a picture of your great-granddaughter?
Yeah, this one right here.
And she's wearing a T-shirt that says strong. How old is she?
She's now 11, We adopted her when she was a little baby. Been taking care of her ever since. And she loves me and thinks I'm the greatest thing in the world. I love her because she is the greatest thing in the world. And she's now a champion fly swimmer. Her plan was if she wins the Olympics, she was going to take those Olympics and say, this is for my grandpa, Leonard Peltier, who they illegally put in prison. This is for him. I said, where'd you come up with that? She won't say that. She just looks at me. Yeah.
You know, we've been covering the climate movement for so many years. We're here in North Dakota covering this standoff at Standing Rock, the Sioux-led, indigenous-led global movement to preserve the environment. And this year, the UN Climate Summit is in just the tip of the rainforest, Belém, in Brazil. And each of these UN climate summits, we see indigenous people, especially young indigenous people, there fighting for the planet. Do you see the voice of indigenous people on the climate movement as hopeful?
We've been talking about this for 250 years, or no, since America was first organized. When we pray and when we, whatever we do, we still talk about Mother Earth and other environment stuff. We haven't stopped. We never will stop. You know, we are still strong environmentalists.
Well, Leonard Peltier, I want to say thank you so much for inviting us into your home. I'm so glad we're not coming to a prison.
Well, so am I.
Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier, speaking in September at his home on the Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota on his 81st birthday weekend. While we were there, I also had a chance to talk to one of Leonard Peltier's daughters, who was just a toddler when Leonard Peltier was jailed in 1976.
My name is Marquita Shields Peltier. I'm the daughter of Leonard Peltier. I'm 52 years old, and I'm standing outside my dad's house after 49 years of imprisonment. My dad is finally free, and I'm home with him.
So you live in Lawrence. You have for decades. Lawrence is not that far from Leavenworth, where he was held for many, many years before moving on to Coleman in Florida. Mm-hmm. What are your earliest memories of your dad?
My earliest memory of me and my dad was actually in Marion, Illinois, when he was there before it was Supermax. I was there with my grandmother, Hazel, and my little brother, Waha, and I remember sitting beside my grandma waiting for my dad to come out those doors for the first time ever, and I remember asking my grandma, I said, do you think my dad's going to like me? And she's like, yeah, he's going to love you. And I said, is it okay if I hug my dad? You know, and she was like, yeah, of course, go hug him. And she kind of pushed me in that door, towards the door. And when it opened and he came out, he just smiled and I ran to him. And I just remember him hugging me. And I was like, that's my dad. That's my dad. You know, because I don't have any memories prior to that. They said we lived together in Oregon, but I don't remember that. They said we saw him in Canada before they extradited him, but I don't remember that.
How old were you when you saw him in Marion?
I think I was around 7 or 8 years old. Yeah.
So what was it like through those years? I mean, it's the only thing you knew, but to visit him only behind bars.
When I was young, it was really confusing. It was hard to understand why, you know, because they kind of protected me, probably because I was so young and I didn't understand what was going on. But it was bittersweet because I loved going there. And like, for me, that was normal, you know, to see my dad there. Even though there's dads around me with my other friends and stuff, I just, for me, that was normal. But as I got older and started to understand what was going on, why he was there, I started to resent it, you know, because every time 3 o'clock came around, I hated it because I knew I was going to have to leave my dad. And I wouldn't see him again, especially that last day of the visit. We would usually spend about a week. And that last day of visits, I would just like, man, I'm not going to see my dad again for six, seven months, you know. And then as I got older, it was just like, oh, my God, what if I don't get to see him again next time? You know, so eventually I packed up my kids and moved to Kansas so I could be closer to him. And then that worked out for about 3 years. And then from there, they moved him again across the country. So, you know, we didn't get to have the relationship I thought we would during that time, just because he was way over in Pennsylvania, then Florida, and I was stuck in Kansas.
And what was your understanding from early on, and did it change, of why he was behind bars?
Yeah, I just, I knew things had happened that were, you know, not, he was, I've always been told and taught that my dad was there because he wanted better for me as his daughter, as a Native person. He wanted people to respect me, not only as his daughter, but just as a Native person, you know, to understand that we are not property or we are not animals or savages, that we are human beings just like everybody else. And as I got older and started understanding his case and what was the, you know, the details of it, and it went from, you know, resenting, not, I never resented my dad, but I resented the government and I resented, you know, but it went from not knowing the extent of it to knowing the full extent of it and just being proud of, like, even though I prayed for him to get out all the time, I knew what he stood for and I was proud and I had to, you know, keep fighting for him because I knew that someday he would get out, you know, and he did. He did, which is unbelievable to me still.
When did you hear that Biden had commuted his sentence and sentenced him to home confinement?
I don't remember the date exactly, but it was sometime at the end of January. I was crazy because I was planning on leaving. I I was going to leave the country and just disappear. Because after his parole was denied in June of 24, I think it was 24, I basically thought my dad was going to die there. So I had given up on everything, and I was getting ready to disappear into Canada and just disappear. But I was sleeping on my mom's couch that morning, and I heard the phone ring, and then I heard my mom, and she said, "What?" And I thought the worst, of course, that they called to tell me my dad was dead. And then my cousin was crying, and she said, "Marquita, I'm so happy." So I was like, "What are you talking about?" She's like, "Your dad's getting out of prison." And I was like, you know, I cussed in my mom's house, and unless I'm joking with her, I just was like, "You're lying. You're lying to me. You're lying to me. My dad's," she's like, "They're Joe Biden and, you know, this, that, and the other." And I didn't know what to do. I froze, and I can't remember if I called my nephew or if I called my brother, who I called, but I called somebody. And I asked them, I was like, "Is it true my dad's getting out of prison?" And they're like, "Yeah." I'm so thankful to millions of people for the last 49 years of my life that helped pray for him, that helped write letters, that helped make phone calls, that sent signed petitions. You know, that's all those people and to help bring my dad home. But the thing of it is people don't understand that, you know, what my dad went to prison, so did we. You know, we were out here free, but we weren't free. We were out here struggling when he was in there struggling. And I was blessed enough to have people like my grandmother and my mom to show me that, you know what, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay.
Leonard Peltier means so much to so many people around the world. Talk about what he means, not just to you as his daughter, but to you as an Indigenous woman.
Oh, man, my dad, I told him this before, he's my hero. The definition of what a warrior should be, you know, to be able to stand strong and still come out of that prison smiling, to be able to set an example. And, like, I look up to my dad because I don't know very many people that could go through the stuff he's been through and still have a smile on his face. And it makes me proud to call him my dad, you know, that's my dad.
Marquita Shields Peltier, the daughter of Leonard Peltier, speaking in September at Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota, where Leonard has been living since being released from prison in February. And that does it for today's show. To see all of Democracy Now!'s coverage of Leonard Peltier and our interview with him over the years behind bars, you can go to democracynow.org. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, and Zazu, the newshound. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astujo, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagera, Hugh Grant, Carl Marxer, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Turrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Get ready for Listen Up. The Geography Student Union presents a night of live music starting at 5 p.m. on November 29th at the Student Union Building Ballroom on SFU Burnaby campus, featuring Sleepy Gonzalez, The Lunchtime Band, and Tiger Really. Tickets are $15, available online or at the door while they last. Open to all ages and everyone.